Hey guys, grab a coffee or a tea and get comfortable. We are about to travel all across Japan without ever leaving home. I am excited to say that this is the first full episode of the At Home Show. My name is Norm, and this is the Tokyo Lens Podcast. Welcome to the At Home Show, and as always, if you are a regular listener, welcome back. So when I was in high school, one of my favorite teachers one day handed me this small red English-Japanese-Japanese-English Yohan dictionary. Yohan is just the brand name of the dictionary. And he said to me that if I learned hiragana within a very short time span, I think it was like a month or something, that he would let me keep the dictionary. To this day, I don't know his true motivation for doing this, but it became the beginning of my journey towards learning the Japanese language. I learned hiragana within a month. I got to keep the dictionary. In fact, that dictionary is always very close by me. And at that time, I would have given probably anything to have a really good Japanese teacher, someone like the guest that we are talking to today. In fact, it wasn't until a couple years later, when I was fairly far along my Japanese learning journey, that I met today's guest. However, it wasn't through our love for Japan or our knowledge of the Japanese language. In fact, it was more in passing, as we both did something called extreme martial arts. It's like martial arts with flips and kicks and jumping off the walls and doing back flips and everything. In this small world of martial artists was my very first encounter with today's guest. Way down in the area of Beppu, on the island of Kyushu, there's a man that I am proud to say is by far one of the most effective and most comical teachers of the Japanese language that I have ever had the pleasure to know. So with coffee cup in hand, I'm happy to say that today we are sitting down with Dokken. All right, good afternoon, Dokken, and thanks so much for joining me. How are you doing today?
Happy to be here. How's it going, Norm? Just for everyone watching, I've got my phone with Norm over here. He's on the screen over here, so I'll be talking to the camera and also to the phone off camera as we do this interview. So just a heads up.
So, Dokken, a while back, I'd say, what are we looking at, almost 6 months ago, I came down and visited you down in Beppu, and we put together a video on, some tips on learning Japanese and everything like that. Mm-hmm. That was, we had so little time that day. Everything was so squeezed in. Wanted to do a podcast and never really got to.
Yeah, and then I forgot. I accidentally deleted that footage that we shot for your video too.
It was a comedy of errors all on its own. So yeah. The content turned out pretty good though, and I thought that perhaps among the many things that we talk about today, we might be able to add, learning Japanese to that list. What do you think?
I'm down. I'm always down for Nihongo Jōzu.
Do you remember your first high impact Nihongo Jōzu situation?
First high impact?
Is there one in particular that stands out in your memory above the rest?
Yeah, there was. Yeah. So when I was studying abroad in Japan, I was dating this girl that lived in Tokyo, and I remember meeting her parents, I don't know, like a month or two after we had started dating, and one of the first things her mom said to me was, "Oh, your Japanese is so good," and I was like, "Oh, thank you, Nihongo Jōzu," and then what happened is, a lot of people had been saying that to me up until that point, and, it's just Japanese people say that to anyone who speaks any Japanese at all. But what happened is I met her mom again, like 3 or 4 months later.
Okay.
And I had been studying primarily phonetics at this point. So I was basically a Japanese beginner in terms of like grammar, vocab, kanji, and stuff like that. But I had a pretty good grasp of like the pitch accent patterns in Japanese and Japanese pronunciation at this point. And normally in Japanese, if you say, are you doing well? The way that you learn it in textbooks and the way that I learned it was like, genki desu ka? Or, o genki desu ka?
That thing that literally no one ever says.
Yeah. And I remember when I met again with my ex-girlfriend's mom, rather than saying either of those, she said, genki ni shiteru? Which is another way of saying it, and it's still a pretty elementary grammar way of, you know, elementary way of saying it.
Yeah.
But because I was focused on phonetics, I didn't understand what she was saying. Like, I knew that she was saying genki, and I knew that I knew, you know, stayed. But I was like, wait, what's happening here with this grammar? And so I was kind of like, And then she was like, and then my girlfriend kind of stepped in and she was like, genki? And I was like, hi, genki desu. And then my girlfriend's mom said, やっぱり日本語上手. Like right after I misunderstood this whole situation. And I was like, wait a second, she doesn't mean that. That's like the first thing. That was like my first time that it clicked, where it was like, it doesn't mean anything if someone tells you that your Japanese is good.
It's essentially a
greeting.
It pulls the rug out from under you a little bit, right? Because the first time you hear it, you actually feel pretty good about yourself. You're like, oh, I have been complimented. And then and then the rug gets pulled. Brings me back. Your story is actually not all that dissimilar from mine. Mine was I was living in Asakusa. And I'd gotten like a couple before then that never really stood out, you know, those kind of build up your confidence Josu's.
But there was
a convenience store right near where I lived. And I used to go there all the time. And the woman would always give me the Nihongo Josu desu ne.
Yeah.
And then there was one day where I said something at the counter and she just straight up corrected me. And I was like, I was not expecting to be corrected by this person who had just been Nihongo Josu-ing me over and over. And I was like, oh. And then as soon as it was done, like I just repeated it back to her, she said the exact same thing. Yappari Nihongo Josu desu ne.
Yeah.
It was like, that was the defining moment for me where I was like, okay, this is like a, it's like a catchphrase of the people.
Yeah. I'd like to also kind of clarify something on this point. I've talked about this a little bit before, but it's kind of become like a meme on my channel and my Twitter. Nihongo Josu.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's really good for comedy, but I really don't like it when foreigners take it too seriously. Like when foreigners are like, well, of course I can speak Japanese. Like, you think I'm stupid or something? And it's like, no. Like, it's a cultural difference thing. Like, this isn't something that you should get, like, upset about. Like, it's... I love making jokes about it because it's a really good premise for a whole lot of different jokes. And I kind of have, like, a challenge to myself of, like, how many different ways can I make this joke and still, you know, have it be fresh? So whenever I can, you know, take an opportunity to make a Nihongo Josu joke in a new way, I do that. But, like, it doesn't bother me at all when people say it to me. And I'd like to... encourage foreigners that are maybe still learning Japanese that who are getting to like an intermediate level and they're starting to realize that it doesn't actually mean anything, that just because it doesn't mean anything doesn't mean that you need to interpret it in a negative way.
That's a really good point too, right? It's those little things that can really impact your overall confidence and general comfort of learning Japanese in general, right?
Yeah. Well, I think there's a kind of a trajectory that a lot of people studying abroad in Japan and also people that live in Japan get on. And that's that there's like the honeymoon phase, where you don't understand that much Japanese, but everything's new, and it's Japan, the Japan you've loved for such a long time, and you're finally there, and maybe you, like, start dating someone, and, you know, you're going to Akihabara and doing all the anime stuff or whatever it might be. And then maybe you're doing, like, English teaching or something like that, and you're a few months later, you're starting to realize, like, oh, I'm not making, like, that much money. I'm getting better at Japanese, but people are just...
This is getting pretty dark pretty quick.
Yeah. Maybe this is, like, 6 months later or, like, 7 months later. Maybe closer to a year. It really depends on the person, but I see a lot of people that start really, really happy, and then usually along the lines of when people are starting to get... tired of the work that they're doing, they also start to get bothered by the small cultural differences and idiosyncrasies of Japanese culture that they loved before. So things like Nihongo Jōzu, whereas before, maybe even though they didn't understand the meaning of that, now it's like it's a trigger.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Have you ever heard of the Dunning-Kruger effect?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So for anybody who doesn't know, it's a lot easier to explain visually. But if I were to explain it in the most basic of ways, it's the less knowledge you have in something, the higher you perceive your skill in it. And therefore, more often than not, the higher you perceive your enjoyment. And as you gain more knowledge, you realize how much bigger this world is, and you perceive your own skill as much, much lower. And it comes in with, like, things like lack of confidence or, you know, imposter syndrome, stuff like that. So it's the exact same with Japanese as it is with photography, right? And when you get a camera for the very first time and you start posting pictures to Instagram and Facebook, especially if you get like a DSLR with like a decent lens, you're like, I'm the best photographer ever. And then after like a couple
this
months or a year,
1.2, I've made it.
Yeah, you're like, look at all that beautiful bokeh in the background. I'm going to be shooting weddings in no time. Nikon, Canon, sponsorships, here I come. And then 3 months later, you're like, I hate everything I shoot. And then it goes from that to you spend more time in it, and you start to kind of develop your own style. And you start to realize that there are different factions of the photography world. There are the street photographers, and there are this and that and the next thing. And I think Japanese is kind of the same. You start out, it's exciting, it's new, it's fresh, you're motivated. Then it gets very real. You realize how big the world is. And all of a sudden, you know, you're faced with these challenges in terms of confidence and understanding and finding your own place within that world. And then eventually you start realizing that there are different factions. There are people who will Nihongo Jōzu you. There are people who will treat you no different. There are people who you could be a native speaker and have my face, and they'll still be like, nope, sorry, I don't speak English. And you're like, I'm speaking Japanese to you, right? And you start to realize that just like anywhere in the world, there are different types of people. And I think that's one of the reasons that I really love what you're doing with Japanese personally, is because you've really found your own faction. You've taken the really complicated aspect of the language, the technical side of it, and managed to break it down and turn it into comedy, while at the same time maintaining enough respect that you can still teach one of the more difficult parts of the it's just for those who might be hearing about you for the very first time. I know we're like, we're a good 10 minutes plus into this episode, but could you explain in a really basic way what it is that you do, what you teach? Because you teach Japanese.
Yeah, I'll try to do this as concisely as possible. Basically, it's very easy to be able to have a conversation in Japanese at like a basic level. And one of the reasons for this is because Japanese pronunciation in general, and I'm talking about pronunciation specifically, not pitch accent, and I'll return to this in a second, but pronunciation in Japanese isn't as complicated as English.
Okay.
For the most part. I'm making a lot of generalizations right now. But most native English speakers can get to a level where they're comprehensible, where people will understand what they're saying in Japanese very quickly. Okay, this is the best way to say this. English speakers don't have to study Japanese pronunciation specifically in order for Japanese people to understand what they're saying in Japanese.
Okay, that's fair
enough. For at least like 80-95% of conversations. That said, there's like a whole other part of the language, the spoken language, called pitch accent. And the best way to think about this is that English is a stress accent language. So if I have a word like tomorrow, then the accent is on the ma bit. And that part of the word is longer, louder, and it has a slightly higher pitch than the surrounding bits.
Okay.
So if I say tomorrow, again, that part of the word ma has a slightly higher pitch, and it's longer, and it has more intensity, more stress than the surrounding bits. And words in English, generally speaking, always have one accent somewhere on the word.
Okay.
So if I say dictionary, it's on the beginning. Or if I say university, it's on the ver. Or if I say hospital, you know, it's on the ha. And again, if I say tomorrow, it's on the ma. Japanese words, some Japanese words are back up. Japanese is not a stress accent language. It's a pitch accent language. So if a Japanese word has an accent, then it's determined by not stress, not impact and length, but pitch and pitch alone.
Mm-hmm.
So if I say Japan, then it's Nihon.
It doesn't become like Nihon.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Or another example that gets used a lot is banana. So in English, I say banana. I'm exaggerating it a little bit, but that's still natural, still a natural way to say it, banana.
Yeah.
Whereas in Japanese, it's not that middle syllable, it's the first syllable, ba, that's high, and then the remaining two syllables are low. So it's banana.
Mm.
And each of those syllables are said with the same length rather than that banana again.
Mm.
So if a word has an accent, then that accent is determined by pitch, not stress. So English and German, and I think Spanish as well, are stress accent languages. They have strong and weak bits, whereas Japanese has high and low bits.
Yeah, and you usually maintain like a similar rhythm. Like each part of the word stays equal.
I think
a really good example of this being done terribly was when the JR trains, I think it was like back in 2008 for a while, they changed the English announcements to sound more native, non-native Japanese friendly. So instead of saying the next station will be Shibuya, they'd be like, the next station will be Shibuya. And they they took away that whole pitch accent and turned it into a stress accent.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, as somebody who believes very strongly in the pitch accent world, if you will, it was so painful.
Yeah, that's a really good example. That was the next point that I wanted to make. So earlier, a second ago, I said that if a word has an accent, then it's determined by pitch rather than stress. But the thing is, like, half of all Japanese nouns and a good majority, not the majority, but a very high number of the verbs and adjectives as well, some adjectives are, not the majority of adjectives, but a good number of the verbs and also some of the adjectives don't have accents at all.
Mm.
So Shibuya is like the perfect example of that.
Yeah.
As native English speakers, we unconsciously want to assign a strong accent to somewhere in a Japanese word. But Shibuya doesn't have an accent.
Mm.
You just say it in a more or less flat way. It starts low, goes up a tiny bit, and then kind of levels out, maybe drops a little bit depending on what the speaker is trying to say, like their intentions and stuff like that. But native English speakers they unconsciously map stress accent patterns onto Japanese words. Mm. And because Japanese speakers typically don't correct foreigners speaking Japanese, and because foreigners can speak Japanese with stress accent and still be understandable, there's a whole lot of people who don't realize that they're making a ton of pronunciation mistakes in Japanese as they speak.
Yeah.
And typically pitch accent isn't taught either because, again, you don't need to learn pitch accent in order to be understandable in Japanese. So, but if you want to sound as native as possible, you have, in my opinion, it's you have to study it. Because it's all a matter of getting rid of all those weird English stress accent patterns and kind of starting clean with Japanese. So, like, the classic example is, like, besides Shibuya, like, the word for student, the overwhelming majority of like, Americans and probably British students as well that are studying Japanese, they'll say, gakusei. But this word as well doesn't have an accent. It's gakusei. Or, like, I don't know, benkyo, so study. That's also benkyo and not benkyo. Or, like, woman. Woman is a really good example. People always say josei. But it's josei.
And this actually comes into play really, really importantly when you get into, like, different Japan. Because one thing that I think a lot of beginners don't realize is that Japanese uses the same word. And, you know, if you're just looking at hiragana, basically same spelling for some words like bridge and chopsticks.
Most of the time, just out of context, native speakers will be able to understand what you're saying, even if your pitch accent is wrong.
Mm.
So even in words like chopsticks, hashi, and, you know, bridge, hashi. Because of context, most of the time, native speakers won't have trouble, you know, understanding what you're trying to say. But again, the point that I like to make is that most Japanese learners don't realize that they're making a mistake to begin with. Mm. So a lot of people don't care about sounding as native as possible. They just want to get to a point where they're understandable. But there's also a whole ton of people who want to develop the best Japanese that they can. They want to sound as native as possible. And for those learners, again, regardless of whether or not you can get by with bad accent, if you want to sound as native as possible, you have to study it. Because you can think of, like, you know, a bunch of celebrities off the top of your head, like, I don't know, maybe like Jackie Chan or something like that. You can understand everything he's saying when he's speaking English, right? Yeah. And he speaks English very naturally, but you can tell 100% that he's not a native speaker. You know, he's got a pretty thick accent. Like, what's his name? Watanabe Ken.
Yeah.
You know, it's like clearly not a native speaker. And it's fine if you don't want to sound as native as possible. But if you do want to sound as native as possible, you have to realize that there's this entire other realm of Japanese phonetics. So spoken Japanese, the sounds of Japanese, that isn't taught in most Japanese curriculums. And that's just because it's, again, because you can get by without studying it. You can be understandable without studying it. Mm. So that's what I teach on my Patreon. Mostly pitch accent, but also pronunciation as well. So, like, there's a lot of rules that can help you determine, like, the pitch accent of a word.
Yeah.
So, like, I talked earlier about how, like, there's a whole bunch of verbs that don't have accents.
Mm.
So, like, a good example of that would be, like, the verb to learn. That's manabu, no pitch accent. Or, like, the word for fly. That's tobu, no pitch accent, or no accent.
Yeah.
But any word that ends with ts, any verb that ends with ts, that will have a pitch accent. That will have an accent somewhere in the word. So, like,
these tiny little details. I had no idea. I've never broken it down
so
like
that. So, like, you'll immediately know what I'm talking about. Like, matsu, motsu, sodatsu, yodatsu, medatsu.
Wow. Yeah.
Immediately. Yeah. You immediately know the pitch accent of a ton of words just by one simple rule. So there are tons and tons of rules like this, and I teach these on my Patreon. And, like, once you have an understanding of pitch accent and how it works in Japanese, you understand, like, the example I just gave, like utsu, motsu, matsu, you know, that's all high to low because it has two syllables. But if it has three syllables, then it's going to be low, high, low. And if it has four syllables, anyways, some are going to be high to low. Some are going to be low, high, low. But once you know that rule, just based on how many syllables the word has, you will know the pitch accent of the word.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that I really enjoy about Japanese is that it's a very learnable language in the sense that much more than English, at least comparatively, it actually follows rules.
Yeah.
But I think for a lot of us getting to this point, there's definitely been like stumbles and failures and everything along the way, and not to put you on the spot, but I want to talk for a moment about like most embarrassing Japanese failure moments. Cause I think we've all got at least one or two moments where we made a fairly large or embarrassing mistake with either the Japanese language or something maybe a little more cultural or something like that.
I've got two good stories.
You know what? I'm gonna let you take the floor because I would love to hear the little, you know, subtle stories that motivated you to bring you where you are now. So you can start with either.
So the first one, this is probably I'll save this one for later. I was with my cousin. My cousin used to live in Japan, and I was studying abroad, and he lived in Kobe at that time, and I went from Tokyo to Kobe, and there was a girl that I knew that was living in Kobe because she had studied abroad at the university that I had attended in the States.
Okay.
So when I was in Kobe, I talked to my cousin. I was like, we should go meet this girl. I know her. She's my friend. And then you can get to know her too. And so we met, it was me and my cousin, both guys, and then this girl, and she brought one of her friends as well. And so we were all talking and, you know, having a good time. And then my cousin, like, as the conversation was ending and we were all getting ready to go, my cousin, said to the two girls, like, you girls, you guys should come over for drinks sometime. And in Japanese, the way to say that is "nomi ni kite ne."
Okay.
And because I think we had talked about, I don't know, like going to some like gaijin bar or something like that. I don't know. Anyways, it was a natural thing to say at that point in the conversation. But he didn't say "nomi ni kite ne." He said "nonde kite," which means "come drunk." Okay. So, you know, we just had like this, you know, fun conversation with these two girls, and, you know, both of these girls my cousin had never met before. And he's like, all right, you know, I'm making some like contacts and cute girls in Kobe, and come drunk.
Come drunk. Come drunk.
So it's so funny because like they were both kind of like, what? So
it makes for a great image at the very least, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And then the second story, this is like the classic story. When I started studying abroad, I had like a kind of a cancer scare because I had like a friend back home who was like diagnosed with skin cancer or something. And then I had like a mole somewhere on my body, and it felt kind of hard. And I was like, it had always been that way, but I was like, I should probably get this checked out. Like, it's not normal for like moles to have like hard spots on them or whatever. And so I tried calling this dermatologist in Japan. And I said, I want to have this mole looked at. But in English, mole means two things. One is like, you know, mole on your face. And then the other one is like the small rodent that like burrows around in the ground. And when I looked up the word mole in the dictionary, I looked up the wrong word. Up like the rodent that burrows around in the ground. So I called up this doctor's office in Japan, and I told them that I'm worried about this rodent that's burrowing around. And they're like, this is the doctor's office. Like, we're a dermatologist. And I was like,
Oh, no. Tell me you didn't tell them that there was a mogura burrowing into your leg.
No, I didn't get that far. Like, basically, the conversation, I wasn't good enough at Japanese to, like, realize what was happening. I just understood that they weren't understanding me. And they were kind of like, what are you saying? And I was just like, click. And I just hung up because I was, like, too embarrassed. And I got it all resolved later. It was just like, you know, it was like a, what do you call it? It's not, is it malignant? I don't remember. It's not, it wasn't a big deal. It wasn't cancerous or anything. It was just like in this hard spot. But I'll never forget that.
I could just like imagine them on the other end of the phone being like, why is this guy calling us about this rodent?
Exactly.
What in the world is going on? Wow. I don't want us to totally run out of time like last time and end up in a complete panic at the end. So let's wrap this one up for now. Call it part A. Maybe we'll be able to do another one of these in the future. Thank you so much for just being a part of this. This has been a lot of fun.
My pleasure, dude. Always happy to speak with Tokyo Lens.
Any closing thoughts, comments? Putting you on the spot. Heavy stuff.
Not really. Just the one thing that I'd like to kind of reiterate is that it's easy to get discouraged during your Japanese studies and particularly during this point in time and what's going on with the world. So if you can, try and make the best of your situation and
otagai ni ganbaro. I like that. And for those of you who don't know what otagai ni ganbaro means, oh Lord, how do you translate? My English is getting bad. It's like, let's do our best.
Yeah, we're in
but
this
it kind of has like, yeah, we're in this together kind of feel to it.
Yeah.
So, beautiful. Thank you so much, Dogen.
My pleasure.
And let's move our way into the rollout.
Okay.
Now, it is fair to say that this is probably the shortest episode recorded of the at-home show so far, but hopefully it packed in a lot of value to it. We had a really good time recording it, and what I've done is, if you would like more information along these lines, or if you'd like to know more about learning Japanese and everything, I've linked everything down in the description. Dogen and I have done other pieces of content together, fully revolved around learning the Japanese language, as well as Dogen's channel, his Twitter, his Patreon, you name it, it is all linked down there. And on that note, in case you are enjoying these episodes but just cannot wait to get the rest, a friendly reminder that they are all currently up on Patreon with the full video versions going up for the video watchers as well. And as both Dogen and I are fairly active on platforms like Twitter, if you have questions for either one of us, or if you'd like to hear some follow-up or a little bit of a Q&A post episode on this, feel free to hit up either one of us. Honestly, even if you don't use Twitter, Dogen's account is a spectacular reason just to join. Like, honestly, just join and follow Dogen. You will not regret it. But with all of that being said, it seems that my coffee cup is once again empty. So it is time to grab a refill so I can kick back with the next episode. Remember just to take a break from the world every now and then. Fill your ears with something a little more positive. Hopefully your day as well. I hope you enjoyed this one, and you guys know I will talk to you again real soon.